Welcome to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice on WSCA 106.1 LPFM. Today is Saturday, April 16th, 2005. I'm Amy Antonucci and happy to introduce our show to you today. Here's what we have coming up. We'll be starting with news, and then we'll be playing you a talk called U.S. Imperialism from a Native American Perspective, which was given by Chris and Liz Charlebois in Portsmouth this past month. We'll have music, announcements, a special book giveaway in the second half of our show, as well as a poem. We'll be ending the show with an episode of Between the Lines out of Connecticut. Stay tuned and we'll go to the news.
The following news stories were compiled by Jeff White. Iraqis increasingly call for U.S. to leave, from the Associated Press. Iraqis are increasingly calling on U.S. forces to leave their troubled nation, emboldened by a newly elected parliament and the growing presence of their blue-uniformed police forces, even though the new Iraqi leaders say it's too early to talk about a U.S. pullout. The calls gained momentum when Shiite and Sunni religious clerics called for protests to mark the two-year anniversary of Baghdad's fall, prompting 4 days of demonstrations across the country. Tens of thousands of mostly Shiite protesters, largely followers of the militant cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, filled central Baghdad's streets Saturday, holding the largest anti-American protest since the invasion. Demonstrations have continued, all echoing the same demand: it's time for the U.S. troops to leave. Protests reflect a growing impatience with American troops, viewed here both as protectors and antagonizers. The Iraqi resistance has targeted U.S. troops and Iraqis seen as cooperating with them. That, in part, has delayed any talk of pullout, with U.S. leaders saying they will only leave when the Iraqi government asks them to go. Hassan Niyama, 33, of Baghdad, said, "The Iraqis will fight until they force the Americans to leave and let us live in peace and security. They are the source of all of Iraq's problems. We consider the Americans our enemy, not our savior from the Saddam Hussein regime. The American troops should leave our country because there is an elected government in Iraq now. If they stay longer, things won't get any better," said Abdul Rahman Hatam, a 21-year-old cook in Baghdad. "We, as Arabs, don't accept any foreigner controlling our country." President Bush has refused to set a timetable for withdrawal, even though more than a dozen countries have already pulled out of Iraq and several more are considering leaving the U.S.-led coalition. UN Human Rights Panel condemns Israel, from the Associated Press. The United Nations Human Rights Commission on Thursday passed a resolution condemning Israel's settlement of the Palestinian territories, saying that Jerusalem should reverse the policy. The resolution, passed by a 39-2 vote with 12 abstentions, says Israel should, quote, "prevent any new installation of settlers in the occupied territories." It also called for Israel to take measures to guarantee the safety of Palestinian civilians. Censure by the UN watchdog brings no penalties, but spotlights a government's record, and delegations lobby hard in an effort to avoid it. The 53-member commission is expected to vote later in the day on resolutions condemning abuses in Belarus, Cuba, and Sudan. And from CNN, Afghan President Hamid Karzai said he wants longer, stronger ties with the United States. Karzai, appearing at a news conference with U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in Kabul, Afghanistan, made the remarks when asked about reports of the forging of bilateral security agreements and the establishment of a permanent U.S. military troop presence in the country, a reference to bases. The two leaders met as Rumsfeld continued his tour of military operations under the U.S. Central Command, including those in Iraq, which he visited on Tuesday. Karzai said during a news conference with Rumsfeld, "The Afghan people want a longer-term relationship with the United States." He said he has raised the issue with President Bush and emphasized that Afghanistan, quote, "is seeking such a partnership and eventually will be making a formal request." Rumsfeld said Washington is looking into ways it can help the Afghan government, such as equipping and training the country's own forces, quote, "rather than the question of military bases and that type of thing," unquote. Permanent military ties are a subject, he said, that is, quote, "presidential in its level of interest." Iraqi refugees are in mortal danger at home, but can't get entry into the United States. From Knight Rider, Aliyah said she was the first woman in her neighborhood to sign up to work with the U.S. government after Saddam Hussein fell. She used to stand shoulder to shoulder with an American soldier in front of a U.S. military camp in Baghdad. As a translator, Aliyah talked to Iraqis who lined up at the entrance seeking compensation for dead relatives and destroyed homes. Now, because of that work, her life is in danger and in limbo. Aliyah, who asked that her last name be withheld out of fear for her safety, fled to Jordan with her cousin after insurgents killed an uncle and kidnapped two family members. Aliyah hoped to find a haven in the United States, but discovered the State Department isn't resettling refugees from Iraq. She's lost her faith in the country she once loved. "We gave them our friendship," Aliyah said during a recent interview at an Amman restaurant, wearing jeans and smoking cigarettes. "We gave them our hard work, and they don't even help us to have a new life." "Is it so hard," she asked, "for America to give a visa to Iraqis to have a new life that they took from them?" Refugee aid workers and U.S. and U.N. officials said the United States had turned away Iraqi refugees because it was trying, instead, to create a democratic society from which no one had to flee, and was sacrificing plenty of American lives in the process. To succeed, it needs the talents of the very people who want to leave. Non-governmental organizations first became aware of the problem as U.S. soldiers approached them for help in getting their translators out of the country, only to be told it was impossible. In Aliyah's case, the soldier was Army Captain Patrick J. Murphy of the 82nd Airborne Division, their supervisor, and an Iraq War veteran who is now working as a lawyer in Philadelphia. He said, "They fought just as bravely as we did over there, and I think we owe it to them as a grateful nation to do everything we can to help them become Americans. Such people should be of special humanitarian concern to the U.S., said Bill Frelick, the director of refugee programs for the human rights group Amnesty International, in a letter to U.S. officials in February. The letter, signed by more than a dozen human rights, church, and refugee aid groups, called on the State Department to resettle Iraqis, including those targeted by the Iraqi resistance who view them as U.S. collaborators. The American government has evacuated a small number of Iraqis through humanitarian parole, a mechanism usually used to let people into the United States temporarily for medical care. A few who reached American shores on tourist or other visas have been able to win political asylum. A former Knight Rider newspaper translator whose family was gunned down on the streets of Baghdad received asylum in the United States. But the United States hasn't resettled any Iraqis as refugees, a category that would allow for a permanent stay since the September 11, 2001 attacks. The Pentagon has been faulted for shortages of critical war supplies by George Kalik. Poor planning, lagging funding, and an ineffective distribution system have led to delays in getting supplies to troops in Iraq, according to a new report by the Government Accountability Office. The agency found the Defense Department spent more than $60 billion supplying troops with 2 million tons of equipment, spare parts, and other items before, during, and after major combat operations in Iraq from October 2002 to September 2004. The report stated, "Despite these expenditures, there have been widespread reports of serious shortages of critical items needed by U.S. troops. Specifically, the General Accounting Office cited shortages of batteries, tires, vehicle track shoes, body armor, meals ready to eat, Humvees with extra armor, and add-on armor kits for Humvees. Auditors found that those items were not available for five reasons that it called, quote, systematic supply system deficiencies." And that's all we have for the news today. Thank you.
That was Alice Gomez with Evening Stars. On April 5th, 2005, local activist groups, Seacoast Peace Response and the Seacoast Alliance for Democracy, hosted a forum where Liz and Chris Charlebois presented a talk on U.S. imperialism from a Native American perspective. In light of the continuing occupation of Iraq by the U.S., there is much interest in hearing insights from the occupied people of the U.S. In anticipation of Earth Day, it also seems appropriate for us to listen to the words of the original inhabitants of the land that we now live on and who have lived in such harmony with the Earth for so long. The Seacoast Peace Response and the Seacoast Alliance for Democracy are really pleased to be hosting this. And Cal Ewing has been the main coordinator, and he's going to come up here and introduce our speakers now.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. That's great. I am part Native American, and I sought to make some connections with the Native community up here. And I wasn't successful for a long time. And then someone at Seacoast Peace Response encouraged me to resume my efforts and try to create a community of my own. And this is part of that work that I've been doing for myself. And so it's personally very gratifying that all of you are here tonight. I would like to introduce Liz and Chris Charlebois. Chris and Liz are Native Abenaki. Liz is the youngest Abenaki basket maker in the Abenaki tradition. Chris is an activist and the keeper of cultural tradition among your people, very highly respected in the Native community. So without further ado, a warm welcome to Liz and Chris.
Cal mentioned I'm an Abenaki basket maker, but I'm just going to give you a little background about myself and what I'm speaking on tonight. I'm going to speak on women's roles in Native culture, because there's a lot of misconception that Native women were somehow subservient. Men were, you know, the brave warriors who took care of everything. And I just want to let you know that it wasn't really that way, you know, just give you a little bit of background about how our family roles work. And again, a little bit about my background. Yes, I'm a basket maker, but I'm also a singer and a jingle dress dancer. My family's been involved in the Native culture since I was real little. First thing I wanted to mention is Native women were not subservient. In the days of the wigwams and the teepees or whatever, the women were the ones who owned the homes. We were the keepers of the lodges. You go to our house, it's still that way. We were the ones who took care of the children and took care of pretty much everything that had to do with the house. If we had a no good man and we wanted a divorce, we just set his moccasins outside, and that was it. As a basket maker, I'm going to use like a basket maker's background as an example. As far as Abenakis were concerned, the biggest thing that the baskets did for us is they were, you know, a major income. We had a huge basket trade anywhere from the 1700s up until the mid-1900s. And, you know, there are still basket makers now, but not as many. During the basket trade, the women were the main breadwinners in the family. They got all the money. The men got us the supplies. We made all the baskets that were sold. In the summertime, the whole family would pack up and go to a tourist area such as Lake Placid. Some Abenaki women became so successful and so wealthy that they actually hired French women to do their housekeeping for them and to watch their children. Or they could hire other Abenaki women who were single or widowed to make baskets to sell. So it's kind of neat to see that the women were the people who made the entire income for the family. Not to say that men did not have their part, but, you know, it's just nice to see that there was that monetary input, even back in the 1700s. Let's see, another example that I'm going to use is as far as drum etiquette is concerned. I don't know how many of you guys have been to a powwow or heard, you know, a Native drum group. But if you look around, you see the majority of the drums are men. You'll hear women singing, but women don't touch the drum. And it's not because we're not allowed to, although it is frowned upon greatly, but not for a reason you would think. The reason that women don't sit on a drum is because they don't have to. we consider drum sacred medicine, a way for men to get in contact with God, Creator, who's ever above us. It's a way for them to cleanse their souls and their spirits. And women do that biologically, so we don't need to. And I've met a lot of women who, you know, when they go to a powwow, they say, wow, I want to do that. How come we're not allowed to? You know, that really stinks. So, you know, it's kind of, I think that it's nice to hear. The reason we don't drum is because, well, we're too strong to drum. We would mess up everything for the guys. The guys do it because they've got to. It's really nice to know that we've already got everything we need inside of us. And biologically, when we menstruate, we're cleansing. When we give birth, we're in touch with the Creator. So, unless there are any questions, I'm going to move on to Chris.
I talked to Cal about, what should I speak on? I wasn't very familiar with the organization here. And so Cal was telling me that you guys have been talking quite a bit on the United States as an imperialistic power in the world. And I said, what? No, I didn't say that. So I said, well, okay, you know, that's something that I definitely have an opinion on, but usually I'm not allowed to share it freely with other people. And it's amazing, you know, when you really want to do something, you've been thinking, wow, I wish I could work on this and work on that. And then when you're given the choice, you go, what am I going to do with it? Now I have all this freedom. I don't know what to do with that. So I started looking at the world around me and just putting a lot of thought into Native culture today. You know, I do a lot of talks on what Native culture was and how it interacted with the dominant society on this continent. And I've even talked about where Native culture is today, but I've never really talked about how it interacts with world politics. It's always been more localized in the United States. The one little bit of background I will give you is, right now I've been working as a crisis intervention specialist, a behavioral specialist for teenagers in the school district for an alternative education program. I see some of you shaking your heads like you understand what I'm talking about, and it's something. We were just speaking, we're on a 13th hour of work today. And so I've got seven kids, seven boys that range in age from 13 to 17. And I sat back and I had my laptop in front of me. Laptops are great. We got to thank the dominant society for laptops. Smallpox we could do without, but laptops are really cool. Okay? So I sat back and I'm looking at these seven young adults. And just to give you a little bit of what I'm looking at in the room, four of the seven are really, really big into neo-Nazi, white racist power, which with some of them come directly from their parents. There are another three that are habitual sex offenders before the age of 17. And I'm thinking, you know, where are we going wrong? You know, and then I thought, man, if it wasn't for disease, these guys never would have conquered this continent. And then I thought, well, how do these young men here differ from my own family? And I started thinking of my daughter, and perhaps Dave may be the only one in the room right now who might understand this little story, but the other day I caught my daughter, she's three, or she will be three in a couple of weeks here. I caught my daughter sitting in the back of the car, looking out at these boulders, talking, and then laughing hysterically, and then talking, and laughing hysterically. And her name is Anzali, and I call her Oz. I say, Oz, what are you doing? And she goes, Daddy, the rocks are funny. And I said, the rocks are funny, hon? And she goes, yeah. So why are the rocks funny? She goes, because they just sit there. They don't go anywhere. And I thought, man, for a three-year-old, she's on the ball. Not because she knows that the rocks don't move. Any three-year-old knows that rocks don't move. But she talks to them. And in our tradition, the rocks used to move. So I can see, it's funny because the rocks don't move anymore. She knows that they can if they really want to, but they choose not to. So I say, all right, I'm kind of seeing the difference now between the culture that I'm raising my daughter in and the culture that I was raised in, and the culture that these young men are sitting in front of me that they were raised in. And then I start thinking, well, you know, if these young children have to put up with this, how does this relate to, you know, how Native people interact globally. So I sat in front of my laptop, again, wonderful invention, with a blank screen for a couple of days. And then I just started writing. And the more I started writing, I started realizing I was writing to people. I very rarely, even though my wife doesn't believe me, I very rarely prepare a speech or anything. But for some reason, I felt as though I had to write down what I wanted to say. And the more I started writing, the more I realized, I'm writing to someone. So I threw away everything I had, and now I had a plan. And I kept looking up at these seven young men who were swearing at me most of the day or doing various other things that would just make you shake your head and wonder. Dear people of Iraq, I am writing you as a representative of the assembled indigenous peoples of the Americas. As a newly acquired colony of the U.S.'s 2K Holy Crusade, I feel obligated to offer advice in dealing with the Great White Father. When our lands were invaded, it was by a madman called King George. Now, more than 200 years later, a new King George has come to power and is again expanding his empire. When the early invaders came to our lands, they brought with them disease that were unfamiliar to our bodies. And more than 90% of all of our people perished, leaving whole villages empty. When these villages were discovered by the intruders, they saw our demise as a sign from their guide that he was cleansing the path for the righteous. Later, they put a name to this phenomenon, calling it Manifest Destiny. Your people are now caught in a renaissance of that concept. The Great White Father, however, has forsaken his own God and chooses to bend and twist his religion to fit his own agenda. His Christian background refers to the faithful as sheep. The Great White Father has taken the sincerity of the faith of the people and created himself as their television shepherd, leading them with fear, not with the hope of a better future. The wolf leading the sheep. The wolf is now at your door, and he brings with him his new religion called Amerocentrism. You are a dignified peoples rich with the wealth of culture and history, and are of no use to the Great White Father. And if your country were rich in tulips, you would have been passed over completely. The worth of your people will first be expressed when the invaders refuse to refer to you by the names of your forefathers, and instead create their own names for you. This you've already seen, being called Arab or Middle Eastern, or Sioux, or heathen, or anything else. They will tell you that you're uncivilized and poor because you do not use their technology. They will try to make you believe that you are inferior. This was done with my own people. They made us feel as though we could not govern ourselves. They tried to prove to the world that we were not equal by how many ball bearings could be fit into the skull of one of our dead. All this after we showed them how to cultivate the soil, fought their wars, and showed them that bathing on a regular basis was not unhealthy. Do not believe these lies. It is their culture that makes no sense. They have little to no respect for anything or anyone. They look upon their elders as useless and cumbersome, often removing them from their community altogether. To them, their elders are no more than children. They do not see the knowledge that is acquired through experience by those who are older, and have no gratitude of their sacrifices made by those who came before. I used to start whenever I give a talk, I used to apologize if I was to offend anyone. But the older I became, the more I felt as though I was not under any obligation to apologize for anything. So I won't. They have very little control of their society, making even their smallest communities dangerous places for their children. Very few take the time needed to give their children the stories of their people and the teachings that will make them good people as they grow up. Instead, they rely on others or technology to show their young ones the right path to follow. And as a result, their young grow up having no sense of themselves. I have seven of those. As a culture, they mistreat their women. The gift given to women to produce children is often seen as a hindrance and a curse. Their opinions are often ignored, and they hold little to no voice on matters concerning their own communities. Perhaps it is the only way that their culture can work. I don't know. How can you understand a culture where the success of a man is determined by how much he can take from his community and not by how much he contributes? The American government has developed many forms of genocide that they readily practice on cultures. Let me explain some of these to you now. The first thing that they will do is to erase any evidence of your ancestors. Your religious and historical landmarks will be desecrated and destroyed in an attempt to erase any evidence that you were even on this earth. First, they'll just try to kill you. Be warned, the cruelty of the Great White Father knows no limits. He recognizes no flag of truce, and the casualties of aggression are not limited to your warriors. They will kill your elders because they are useless to them anyways. They will beat and kill your children, calling them bastards, and they will rape and kill your women, referring to them as whores. But your people will not perish from this earth. They will then force you onto concentrated encampments that they call reservations. In the past, these have been proven to be so effective that the design was used by Hitler for the systematic persecution of the Jews. In this manner, the Great White Father can better control the actions of your people. It will be easier for their government to infiltrate your government and appoint leaders who are more willing to bend and sway in whatever direction the Great White Father wishes. And still, your people will live. Beware of integration and conformity. At first, they'll try to breed your culture out by integrating your people into their culture. They will disguise this, making you feel as though they're trying to help you, calling it inner city work programming, which is why we had so many wonderful Mohawk people building skyscrapers in New York City. When what it really is relocation and reprogramming. When this fails, they will then shift the focus onto your children, offering to educate them in the civilized way. Oh, what a deal. They will take your children from you and move them far out of your reach. They will dress them in their clothes, cut their hair in their way, and strip them of all identity. They will be beaten for speaking their language. They will be beaten for singing the songs of their fathers. They will be beaten for doing the dances of their ancestors. They will be beaten for practicing their religion. They will be beaten for sharing the stories of their people. And this is the freedom that was promised to you. And they call us savages. What they don't understand is that savages are not born. They're created. But your children will be okay. Their bodies will heal, and their memories will not fade, because they're your children. And they will pass on the gifts that you've given them. Now, let me give you some helpful advice. Do not, I repeat, do not accept any blankets. Do not volunteer to fight under the service of the Great White Father. Do not believe in the illusion of citizenship. As with my own people, it will be granted by the president and not through Congress, and as a result can be revoked by the president at his convenience. They will set up a system of laws and rules that will be used to control your society. Some of these laws will only apply to your people and not to the invaders. They will call this system the Just Us system. Do not sign any treaties or agreements. The Great White Father has no respect or loyalty toward his own people. He participates in the very actions that he publicly condemns, and therefore is a man with no honor. If a man such as this cannot keep agreements with his own people, then no such treaties will be honored towards yours. The most important bit of advice that I can give you is never, never give up. Your culture has survived for thousands of years and cannot be so easily dismissed. I want to wish you all the best of luck during this difficult transitional period, and find myself saying to you what has been said to me countless times, and I always scoff it off when someone says it to me. But I kind of understand it now. I am so sorry for what my people have done to you. I want to thank you guys for inviting me.
Questions, comments? I would like to actually see that that's sent to our comrades in Iraq. You know? That was really good. That was...
Considering the present Bush regime, are you concerned at all about losing tribal sovereignty? Considering, you know, a few years ago that there was a bill they were trying to pass that would negate sovereignty for the tribes.
Lately, we've been very fortunate. When Dances with Wolves came out, we were noticed, which wasn't always a good thing. It was kind of nice not being noticed. And with being noticed publicly in the United States, we kind of hit upon the big Native American craze. A lot more was happening in politics concerning Native people. And now that, especially now that the Republicans are so bent on just kind of conquering the world at the moment, I'm kind of liking not being noticed at the moment. And it's always a concern. It's been a concern for 500 years. You know, the Abenaki people themselves were only noticed in Canada. We're not recognized from the United States.
We were state recognized until Howard Dean was governor of Vermont, and then he revoked state recognition of the Abenaki. So, yes. We're actually now going through that process again.
Why? Howard Dean?
Howard Dean.
Why did he do that?
The Abenaki people never treated with the United States. So if the United States, if the Bureau of Indian Affairs recognizes the Abenaki people, then they have a very big legal battle on their hands as far as territory and land rights.
Yeah, Vermont is very afraid of a casino or land claims, yeah. Anything that might involve some sort of reparations to the Abenaki.
What do you think about casinos?
Casinos have been a hot topic ever since the Mashantucket's opened theirs. Gambling has always kind of been a big part of Native culture, but putting that aside, I can see where people are concerned and upset about making money through basically a syntax sort of way of making the money. However, the Mashantucket Pequots have helped out other Native communities other than their own, sending money to those third world Native communities across the country. At this point, you know, we're done with the Indian Wars of the Plains of the 1800s. The wars now with Native people are being fought in business suits and across desks in the United States. You know, and as far as I'm concerned, we're very close to extinction. We make up just over 1% of the American population. Whatever it takes to sustain our culture, and if that means casinos, then casinos it is.
I was just wondering what you think about the campaign that our government and military uses on Native culture as far as recruitment. I noticed there's a lot of young Native Americans going off to fight in Iraq, and they're very, you know, proud to serve their country, of course. But I'm wondering if the Native peoples or any particular tribes have come out against that or had any kind of declaration saying, you know, this is not our war to fight. We should be focusing our energies elsewhere.
In World War I, we had over 10,000 Native people that fought and died in World War I. They weren't citizens of the United States yet. And many of them never got paid for their services. Native people, as a whole, are very loyal. And I don't want to get into the whole warrior society sort of concept. I know David is a veteran. My brother fought in the first Middle Eastern War and is getting ready to return for a second time. He certainly doesn't agree with the politics, but he sees himself as a soldier. He sees himself as a member of this country. Military traditions in Native families are very strong. When we open a powwow, most places that open a powwow, you have your grand entry song, your flag song, and your veteran song. You know, and we honor our veterans. We honor the veterans of our communities as well as the veterans of our country.
Well, a lot of that comes from being, in the past, a warrior society. We're proud of the people who fight for us.
But it doesn't have to mean that you have to agree with the politics of where you are at the time.
I was just curious if any tribes have come out against this war publicly or, you know, against the
A tribe as a whole, I'm not aware of. But I certainly know many, many, many Native people that are not happy with where our government is right now. And I'm not happy with what we're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Yeah, what's the range of the Abenaki? I always think of it as being the main tribe. It's actually predominantly all of New England and a great part of Quebec. The Abenaki were one of the largest tribes on the eastern seaboard, New Hampshire, Vermont, most of southern Quebec, parts of the Maine. And in fact, I don't know if Dave's going to agree with me, but for a long time, the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy were considered eastern Abenaki.
They were called eastern Abenaki. But, it comes into that name change when the settlers came in. A lot of times they either couldn't pronounce or just refused to call us by the names that we referred to ourselves as. So they like to clump us into groups. You know, the Lakota people, you often hear them called Sioux, which is a French derogatory term. And it's this French slang, which kind of, you know, snake in the grass. Many of the native cultures, their names were changed, or they were just clumped in as one group of people, even though they were completely different cultures. And, you know, I'm sure for a long time the Passamaquoddy and the Penobscot didn't really appreciate being referred to as Eastern Abenaki, because they were Passamaquoddy and Penobscot.
Yes, I was just wondering what your take is on that young man killed nine people and himself. Terry Schreiber, the president, jumped in on that, but yet he didn't do anything to comment on what was happening out here at that school. What's your take on that?
And may I just add, that was my question, and you just added a sentence to that. I got an email saying that there was a coalition of Native American groups that tried to make some contact with Bush about how long he remained silent after that happened. And I wonder if, in fact, he ever did acknowledge that it happened or make a statement or anything on it. So, sort of extension of that question.
My initial reaction was complete shock. I read somewhere that the Red Lake Reservation where this took place is one of the poorest reservations. And it really saddens me to think what this poor family was going through, what was going on in this boy's mind to make him feel that he needed to do this. What had his living conditions done to him?
The president didn't even acknowledge it.
I think the president was too busy taking money away from old people.
I wasn't really shocked when I heard about it. Have any of you ever been on a reservation? If you are fortunate, you get to go on to one of the good ones. And what I mean by when I say that is, I'm kind of fortunate because the Abenaki Reserve at Odenak is a very nice reserve. It's very small. It's only 2 miles by 3 miles. They're very nice one-story houses. They're putting together a brand new museum right now. It's very nice. But when I say, if you were fortunate, you got to go on one of the good ones, I mean the exact opposite. Okay? Native American reserves, especially in America, they're third world America. They're worse than third world America. Unless you live on a reserve with a casino, when a tribe is given government recognition, they're given this big chunk of money. And they're told, all right, you need to create a clinic center on your reserve. You need to create schooling on your reserve. You need to create a tribal headquarters, emergency services, a police force, and you need to develop some sort of employment for the people on your reserve. For a long time, that meant factories of one form or another.
Our people had a cheese factory.
Yeah, we had a cheese factory at Odenak.
We produced soda for a while.
Soda and cheese. Factories, they come and go with the economy. So when the casinos came about, it helped to, you know, if you're fortunate, you lived on the reservation now that had a casino. Your parents had a place to work, you had food coming in, you had commerce coming and going out of your reserve. For those that had their reservations long before then, you have the factories would be gone in a matter of a generation or two. Now you have no income. The alcoholism rate is very high on these types of reservations, as they are in any ghetto situation in this country. The drug rate is very high in these places. Yeah, and with that comes violence. This poor young man grew up on a reservation that was very much like this. There's no hope, because you're stuck. You leave the reservation, you're not wanted off of it. If you stay on the reservation, you're accepted, but what sort of life do you have? His father was dead. His mother was in a vegetative state due to a car accident. He lived with his grandfather, who remarried, and I believe it was an interracial marriage. I'm not quite sure exactly how that all came about. And this kid has nothing to look forward to. Now, how easy is it to join a cult? They'll accept you, right? You know, this kid's already angry at the outside world around him for everything. So let's find someone else who's as angry as me. So he starts visiting all these websites, the neo-Nazi websites. Neo-Nazis will take anyone. But I wasn't surprised. I was surprised maybe that it hadn't happened yet. I mean, there's violent acts on reservations that occur every day that don't make it in the news. There are violent actions that happen against Native people every day that don't occur in the news. Bill Clinton was the first president since Andrew Jackson to do a huge movement of Native peoples from one reservation land to another against their will. The biggest one since Andrew Jackson moved to Cherokee. Didn't make any papers, except the Native newspaper. She never heard about it.
Could you talk about that? Because I haven't heard about that.
In the Southwest, I'm trying to remember which tribe it was. One of the Little Hopi communities, well, little, I mean, it was good size. They raised horses. That was their main source of income. They found, and I don't understand why this was so important, but a huge coal deposit. I didn't think we were really using coal anymore. But they found this huge coal deposit under their reserve. So Bill decided he needed this coal. And reservation land is just that. It's a reservation, just like Yellowstone Park or Mount Washington, or you can move the animals, you can move the people. So they said, you've got to move. Well, these people didn't want to move. They were still on their ancestral land. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, along with the Department of the Interior, which is where we're housed, we got moved from being under the War Department to the Department of the Interior. We are the two-legged endangered species of America. It's okay, you can laugh out loud. they decided they didn't want to move. This was their land. It always had been. So the BIA with the Department of the Interior took helicopters, and they rounded up their horses with these helicopters and then used machine guns and killed all the horses. Now you have nothing holding you to the land. Now we can move you.
I thought the reason that you could have casinos on the reservations was because that was not part of the United States. Not under the same laws as the
If a crime is committed on a reservation, do you know who handles it?
No.
The FBI. It's handled by the FBI.
But isn't that true about the reservations in some of these states? That
all land in the United States borders belongs to the United States government. They can do with it whatever they want. Reservations get smaller. Look at maps of reservations. They have them over a timeline, and they just shrink and shrink and shrink. And even the reservation, Odenak in Quebec, our own reservation, you can own a house, but the land you put it on belongs to the Queen. And she can ask you to move your house whenever she wants.
David, did you have a question?
Yeah. What's going on in Canada and the United States, there's a push between the two governments to eliminate the sovereignty of Native American. And a lot of our rights, the Parliament just passed a law saying that the quarter-blood Indians are not no Indians anymore. People that look exactly like me, I'm not Native. And they get rid of a lot of the bloodlines.
And that brings me to another thing that I wanted to point out. The only things that are counted by blood quantum are Indians, racehorses, and dogs.
And right now, the Canadian government, in 5 years, they plan to eliminate at least 50% of the natives. Because right now, a lot of the native land borders on woodland. That's real prime cuts. And right now they're having a really big fight in Canada about one of the wood lots that contains millions and millions of logs.
Steve.
A little bit of a change of topic here. Remember you said that Native people are justified to do whatever they need to survive, and it's kind of an economic struggle now. And I see that kind of in a similar ironic light to what the United States is doing in Iraq, as far as we kind of have to do this economically for our future to have the American way of life. It seems like an ironic little parallel. So I guess what I'd like you to comment on that if you'd like, and also the question is who we are. You know, I'm not going to try to blanket on you like native thought. You must have the same ideas. Like you talked about humanity being, we're all just one big family in a way, and perhaps understandably you have a more focused identity, and we all have our own identity circles. So
my first comment is, as far as Native people struggle to survive and the United States struggle to survive, with Native people it's a struggle for life. As far as the United States way of life, it means whether we're going to continue to be the biggest consumers in the entire world. I don't know. You know, I kind of see a difference.
I get your point, indeed.
Two things. Where can people get information about what's going on in Native culture? I know in Portland, Oregon, there was a station called KVOO, which is a community station. They had Native American news every day, I believe.
You can subscribe to this wonderful newspaper. It's a national Native newspaper called News from Indian Country. And it's not great. I think it's like, what, $19 a year or something like that? It's very cheap. And they cover Native issues from Alaska, well, from Hawaii, actually, to Jamaica, just about. I mean, it's...
And there are also internet newsletters, too. If you do some research on the internet, you should probably subscribe to it.
Just a quick thing on the Iroquois Confederacy. Could you... mention, a lot of people aren't aware of how much influence they had on the U.S. foreign government. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of people now, Americans, have no clue that they actually, their government, our government is modeled.
The majority of the Constitution was modeled after the League of the Iroquois Confederacy, under their own bylaws. He used to give this example when he would address the colonies, I guess, in Philadelphia. And it was this, Ben Franklin I'm talking about, it was a demonstration of arrows. I don't know if you've ever heard of this or not. He would take an arrow out and he'd say, if an arrow is a colony, and he'd break it, and he'd say, you know, colonies break easily. And then he would take out 13 arrows. And he'd hold them up and he'd say, you know, I can't break these 13 arrows when they're together. And he would use it as, you know, as an example of the strength of a league instead of the individual.
I also just wanted to say that I think the suffragist movement may have gotten more of their inspiration from the status of the Native women, especially up in Seneca Falls. Can I also ask you what your feeling is on the new museum on the mall, the National Museum of the American Indian?
Haven't been to it yet, but...
I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
We went to it when it was in New York. Actually, our friend Susie Husted, Hal knows, some of you may know her too. She actually worked for the museum for a long time.
I get to play in all of that neat stuff in the back.
You know, it's kind of a pro and con kind of thing, you know. It's a little touchy with the artifacts, you know, and I'm not going to get into NAGPRA because that's a whole other ball of wax, and I'm just not prepared to do that right now. But it's also great that there's some sort of cultural education going on in this country.
Right. A lot of people don't realize how much Native America has contributed to, you know, I think it's now like 90% of the food that we eat on a day-to-day basis. You know, derived from Native foods. You know, there's a lot of how we do things in this country is based on.
Thank you, Chris, Liz. Thank you, David.
Indian legislation's on the desk of the do-right congressman. He don't know much about the issues, so he picks up the phone and asks the advice of the senator out in Indian country, darling of the energy companies, ripping off what's left of the reservation. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the corporate bank. They're sending federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart at wounded knee.
The Indigo Girls with Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. We now hear from Jim Page with Whose World Is It?
Seven seas, relative humanities, every
Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at me. Nation states and borderlines, divided states of mind. Politics comes to blows and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know, 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world will our children receive after all is said and done? What kind of creed have we come to believe that they may never receive one? Our children receive after all is said and done. What kind of creed must we come to believe if they are ever to receive one? Seven seas, relative humanities. Everywhere I look, I see someone looking back at